wanted to hop on really quick before this episode started and give a quick trigger warning. This entire episode does center on eating disorders and ADHD, and we do go quite a bit into the details of eating disorders and the triggers and kind of the ins and outs of what causes the mindsets that then cause eating disorders. So if any of that is triggering to you, feel free to sit this one out or come back to this episode at a later date. And then in addition to that, we also talk about ableism, self-harm and suicide, both of which are time-stamped, fat phobia and unrealistic beauty standards. There's a brief mention of sexual assault, body hatred, diet culture, and orthorexia. And then if you haven't listened to our last two episodes, we talk about the fact that we rebranded. So there is no more Serafina Blog anything. Although everything that was on serafinablog.com is now on mindfulmindspod.com. So none of the content's gone, but the actual website doesn't exist anymore. Our Instagram is now mindfulmindspod, and then our email address is now mindfulmindspod@gmail.com. So if you're looking to contact us or looking to find us on any social media platforms, find us under mindfulmindspod. And then lastly, if you haven't yet, we would really appreciate a rate and review. We experienced some unfortunate 1-star ratings from some angry religious folks. And so if you're a listener and this podcast means something to you, it would mean the world to us if you were able to review and rate and leave a little comment about what this podcast has done for you. I would really, really appreciate it. Aside from that, I hope you guys enjoy this episode. It's a really great one, and Asher shares some amazing insight into what it's like to have eating disorders and ADHD. Hi, all, and welcome back to Mindful Minds. Thank you so much for joining us today. Today, we're going to be talking about how ADHD and eating disorders interact with Asher Saruya of Bad Ash Therapy. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Good. Thank you so much for coming on. I was just telling you about the fact that I've had quite a few guests, and we've talked about eating disorders before, and I've had different listeners express interest in ADHD and express that they would really relate to an ADHD episode, but we haven't really gone into ADHD too much, nor have we gone into how those two relate at all, which I'm, for personal reasons, excited to learn about because it applies to my life.
I do not blame you.
But do you want to give a little bit of background on yourself and your page before we dive into all the topic material?
Yeah, of course. So it's funny that you mentioned that you are interested in this because it's personally relevant to you, because that is also why I do this work, because it is personally relevant to me. I am a social worker. I have my master's degree in social work. I'm licensed, it's LMSW, licensed masters of social work. ADHD, got it. And I'm currently working towards my clinical hours to get my license of clinical social work. And I came to this work more broadly because of my own personal experience, mostly around eating disorders, complex trauma, and later I learned ADHD and OCD.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, do you want to, like I said, we haven't talked about ADHD too much. And so do you want to give a little bit of context into what ADHD is? And that can be as broad or as narrow as you want it to be, but it might be good to have some context before we get started.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that when we talk about the definition of ADHD, and one of the things we were saying off mic is I'm not always great at definitions, but I'm going to do my best. But the thing that I think is really important here to remember is that like basically any and all diagnoses in the DSM, our understanding of them, our labeling of them, all of these things have changed, evolved over time, usually for the better, right? Like used to be that homosexuality was in the DSM. So like, good thing that's not in there anymore.
Yeah, we've made some progress. Yeah.
You know, but there are still a lot of issues with the DSM.
Yes.
And neurodivergency in particular, I think, is something that there's been a lot more research coming out about it in the last 20 to 15 years. And as per usual, the research is usually like 10 to 15 years behind lived experience and like clinical work. So I think people understood some of the things about ADHD that we now understand before the research came out, but now we actually have research to back it up.
Right.
And all that is to say that the way that we used to understand ADHD, and actually we didn't call it ADHD, we only called it ADD, attention deficit disorder. And now we understand that it's it's it can be both, and it can be a combo, and it, or both in combo. Those are the same thing. They can be either or. You can have the hyperactive element of ADHD, attention deficit and hyperactivity disorder, or you have the more attention deficit aspect of ADHD, or you're a combo, which combo. So that in and of itself, you know, the understanding that it is not just being what we might label colloquially as distracted. That's what we often think about with ADHD, especially when it was called ADD, attention deficit. We have an issue with focusing our attention, which is true. And also those of us with ADHD tend to hyperfixate on things. So there are moments when we can provide attraction or attention, excuse me, to something. And so it's not that we can't focus. It's that we don't have as much control over where our focus goes and how it functions. We have we have very specific motivators. So some of those motivators include something being challenging. So that's why a lot of times a tell in kids is like, if they're bored in the classroom, that can be an indicator that they should be screened for ADHD. Another one is just genuine interest in a subject. So if you just genuinely want to dive into it. Now, I'm sure most of you who have ADHD or suspect you have ADHD have also struggled to engage in tasks that you're genuinely interested in. And that is because we also struggle with task initiation and executive functioning, which basically just means the steps it takes to do a thing. And so even when we are interested in it, it can be really difficult, partially because we don't know where to start because it feels too big. And so there are lots of ways that we can learn to work with that. And that's the way that I go about treating ADHD. You know, a lot of people very often when they talk about ADHD, they focus on medication intervention. And although that can be supportive and for some people, like, incredible, for others, it can be very complicated. And that's also when we get into the intersection of ADHD and eating disorders, because the typical medication intervention for ADHD is a stimulant. There are non-stimulant options, but even those non-stimulant options tend to have the same side effect of appetite suppression. And as you might imagine, when you're trying to recover from an eating disorder, having a substance that suppresses your appetite can make things pretty complicated. And it's also a very common intersection of ADHD and eating disorders. And having an eating disorder to me is a flag that I need to screen for ADHD in and of itself, because it is such a it's a sensory action. It's an impulsive action. There's a lot of pieces to the ways that eating disorders function that fit very nicely in the ways that ADHDers naturally learn to self-soothe. So that was a lot. I just dumped
That all makes so much sense. I think that was actually a really, really great definition. And I think the thing that's so interesting is we've talked about this before on the podcast quite a bit, because I'm not the biggest DSM fan.
I mean, yeah, appropriately so.
And so we've talked about the fact that largely because of the autism community, there's been a really drastic shift in really all mental health diagnoses, where we're kind of just slowly getting closer and closer to looking at everything from a spectrum perspective. Which I think is just how it should be. And the hiccup with that is medication hasn't caught up. And so medication isn't meant to be prescribed on a spectrum basis. It's meant to be very like black and white. There's very little nuance. And so you have all these people learning, okay, maybe I have, you know, kind of I'm lower on the spectrum. It's not really, it doesn't impact me that much, OCD. And maybe I have really intense depression, and like, how do I manage those things with therapy and medication? And it doesn't really add, like, the things that we're learning haven't quite completely crossed over into how do we treat these things? Which is super frustrating and confusing, I think, for a lot of people, because you're now learning more about your brain and you're realizing, okay, here are the issues. Oh fuck, now I can't do anything about it, which is like really overwhelming. And so we've talked before about the fact that we were talking about it in context of autism, and then in context of anxiety and depression and OCD and bipolar disorder is a big one that has moved a little bit more towards spectrum basis diagnoses. And then it makes sense that, you know, ADHD would also, you know, apply to that. And then simultaneously that you hear so many horror stories of people in their childhood who were either misdiagnosed with ADHD or were just bombarded with medication.
Yeah.
And it makes sense that if you were treating and diagnosing and medicating based off of a not really an accurate like scale of diagnosis, that that would really like create for a lot of maybe not even just like misdiagnoses, but just kind of like you just missed shy of what you actually wanted to diagnose.
Yeah.
And there were, I've heard so many people that the goal, or not even goal, I guess the instant action of a lot of doctors like in the late 90s and early 2000s was just pumping kiddos like full of medication. And not that medication cannot be helpful, but when what you're looking at diagnosing isn't quite accurate, the medication probably isn't going to match up and be accurate simultaneously. And then there's also, you know, been a lot of studies into women with ADHD and like how that has drastically changed the research field. Same thing with autism, like that
completely. Well, I mean, that in and of itself. Yeah, there's like a whole new, I think, movement growing to think about ADHD and ASD as existing on the same spectrum, which I think is fascinating and totally understand and see, like, as someone who treats both clinically. So, yeah, I mean, there's so many pieces to what you just said. There was something that you said that I wanted to hop on, and of course now it has left my brain. Most of the people that I work with are people who were raised as cis women, so they're not all cis women, but they're people who were raised to assuming that they were cis women, and so they were socialized in a very specific way.
Right.
And so they would fall under people who, you know, the women with ADHD experience looking different, which really is that when we're socialized in certain ways, our experiences become externalized in different ways. And specifically for people who are socialized as women, we tend to internalize a lot of things and think many things are our responsibility and our fault, whereas cisgender men are socialized, and this is huge broad strokes, to externalize and to say that the problem is outside of them. And so what often happens with ADHD for those who are socialized to internalize is a lot of the symptoms are internal. They're in their mind. They're sensory seeking activities that are less noticeable, that are less disruptive, perhaps, than, you know, the young boy running around the classroom screaming.
Right.
He obviously has ADHD. You know, he's the one that got the medication shoved in his face. Right. I don't see as many of those people. I see more of the people that got missed. But even so, everything you said is absolutely accurate. And, you know, I think the other piece of this is not only has there been a tendency to like over-medicate and just kind of throw medication at the problem, so to speak. In that realm, there's no effort to help neurodivergent people learn how to work with their brains. It is all about trying to make your brain as neurotypical as possible. And so generally speaking, we as people with ADHD don't learn the tools to manage our ADHD because we're just expected to use the medication to manage it. But that's not sustainable for so many different reasons, one of which is the intersection of an eating disorder, for example. You know, we have to learn how to at least recognize what's happening for ourselves and manage them without medication because we can't always rely on the medication.
Yeah, not to mention, like, if we're looking at accessibility, medication isn't always accessible.
Well, right,
medication,
we're in the middle of a
shortage.
An Adderall shortage. Perfect example. So,
even if you have great health insurance and you have a job and you have income and you have income that can be applied to medication management and all of those boxes are checked, you have access to a doctor, you have access to a psychiatrist, blah, blah, blah.
Right, it has to all line up perfectly.
Yeah, it all has to line up. Even if that lines up, now we're facing a shortage where even if all of those boxes are ticked, you still might not be able to get the medication that you need. And I don't think that people who haven't been on medication and then been taken off of it abruptly understand the severity of what going on to a medication and then being pulled off of it does to your system.
Yeah.
I had a very negative medication management experience as a child. And have a mood disorder, and I basically got prescribed an antidepressant by a pediatrician instead of a psychiatrist or a therapist. Wasn't screened. There wasn't even like a questionnaire. It was literally just like, she's sad, like right. antidepressants.
Yep.
And I was, you know, 15 and was put on Lexapro and Prozac, which now classic. If you look at like research with Prozac shouldn't be given to anyone under the age of 18. There's like really significant like developmental things that can go wrong. It's just not great for adolescents. Yeah. And, I was on Lexapro, maxed out my dosage very quickly, like was not working. And instead of shifting me or sending me to a psychiatrist, I got prescribed Prozac and was put on it and exhibited like 15 of the 20 something allergic
reactions.
Oh, yeah. Right. Yeah. Like really intense.
Yeah.
It aggravated all of my impulsive behaviors. I became like really fixated on self-harm. Suicidal ideations jumped really high. Appetite changed, weight loss, like a hot flash. I mean, like literally anything you can think of. And my mom is a big, like, let's read the side effects person. And so she looked up the side effects and was like, hang on, called my pediatrician. And my pediatrician's advice was, we'll just take her off it immediately. Now, we're talking about me having been on medication for a year straight. And I started exhibiting, like full drug withdrawal symptoms.
Yeah.
And I was in withdrawal for like 2 weeks and I had a fever. I was vomiting. Like it was just like, it was a nightmare. Yeah. And my behavior spiked. Like I became super just like irrational and, like violent and just all these different things that like my poor mom was trying to handle with like zero mental health intervention. Like there was no professional that was helping guide her through that. And obviously there are times where if there's like a really adverse reaction, the only option might be to get the person off that medication as soon as possible. But there are ways to do it in a much safer environment than done.
Absolutely.
And so when you're looking at people, a lot of people in their 20s on Adderall posting on social media, like, I don't know what to do. I'm almost out of my medication. And maybe they're in college, maybe they're by themselves, maybe they live alone, like trying to go through a withdrawal like that on your own without having mental health support, it's really not a safe thing. And so even at the very height of privilege of having all of those boxes ticked, there are still a lot of things that can go wrong. And that's not to like shit on medication, because medication can also be the only thing that helps people survive and live their life in a way that is functional. But it's just not a perfect system. And then let's cover, I can literally just read a definition of eating disorders, because we've quite literally, I mean, we've done like 5 episodes on eating disorders. I've talked about it a lot. So if you just Google eating disorder, it says any range of medical conditions or mental conditions, I'm sorry, in which there is a persistent disturbance of eating behavior and impairment of physical or mental health. And so, you know, there's a lot of different ways that can manifest. And if you want more context on just eating disorders, you can go back and look at one of the episodes that we've done about eating disorders. And I want to say we have one coming up as well, or one that maybe has released by now. So there's a lot of them. Look back, you'll find one. But when we move into the interaction between these two, do you want to give a little bit of some context on how these two disorders can kind of become siblings and, like you said, kind of like perfectly help each other to, you know, lead to, I don't know, dysfunction?
Yeah. I mean, they're fast little friends. they like to have a dance. So it's hard because everybody has an individual experience. So I can just use my own as kind of an illustrative point. So growing up, I had a tendency to restrict and binge, and I didn't realize that's what was happening. Part of the thing that was happening was I didn't realize I also had sensory issues related to food. And so I would be very picky with my food, or I would hyperfixate on certain foods. That was the other thing too. I wasn't always picky in the sense that like I wouldn't try certain things. I would try like anything, but if I like, for example, there was this one summer that I was obsessed with mandarin oranges, and then I could never eat a mandarin orange again, of course, but you know, so I had hyperfixations. I didn't understand were hyperfixations. And so if I couldn't get the food that felt good to me in that moment, I just wouldn't eat. And then I would get very, very hungry. And then I would binge. And then at a certain point, I also was regarded as the fat one in the family, despite the fact that looking back, I wasn't really actually fat. As someone who is actually fat now, I can say that. but socially, within my family, within the context that I lived, I was bigger than other people. I was not lanky. I was not the 90s, early 2000s beauty standard, shall we say. So therefore, I was fat. You know, it's a complicated piece of that. But in any case, so my weight was going up, and that became associated with the binging that I was doing. But there was no acknowledgement that the binging was a direct reaction to the restricting, right? But then my body was changing, and I was getting all these messages that my fat body was bad and that my fatness was also related to the way that I was eating, the binging part of it. Or even when it wasn't binging, when it was just like, I would like a bowl of pasta, thank you. I can't eat pasta. You can't eat pasta. You're fat, right? Like stuff like that. So all of this was happening. And again, a lot of this I understand in hindsight. So the way that I explain it is not the way that I understood it at that point. And I want to really like hammer that home, because I think there's a lot of people who experience that and look back and they're like, oh, fuck. So in any case, so my weight started going up. That was associated to me with the way that I was eating. And it was very clear to me that fat was bad, that it was not a good thing for me to be that. And so what initially had nothing to do with my body size, what was really just sort of an eating pattern that was driven by my neurodivergency that I didn't realize, it eventually morphed into disordered eating due to the desire to control my body size.
Right.
And because I was so focused on the binging, which so many people are, because that's the behavior that feels so monstrous, disgusting, et cetera, whereas like restriction is lauded and in some ways glamorized. I would problematize the binging so much that I was so focused on, I have a binge eating disorder. And like, I guess if you look at the DSM, perhaps, but if you think about it, if the root of something is restriction, and you're binging in response to not eating enough, or you're eating in ways that don't feel good for you because you haven't been consistently nourishing, which is basically what happens to most of us. Is that really binge eating disorder? I don't know. Is it? And so I went through this process of like, am I a binger? Am I a restrictor? Like all this stuff. And then I realized, oh shit, this all existed before my body stuff even started. So really and truly, this is all ARFID from my ADHD. Which also illustrates the point that the DSM is garbage and all these boxes are garbage because, as I just explained in my own experience, I hit basically every single diagnostic box in the entirety of the eating disorder, like canon, and went across, you know, throughout different diagnoses. So,
but the context is so important.
Exactly. And all of these pieces are relevant to the larger story, right?
Right.
It's the bigger picture here, which is it's not the individual behaviors. It's that context of the larger story and what happened first and what led to what. And ultimately, at the end of the day, if I had known that I had ADHD, if I had been taught what that meant for me in terms of my relationship with food, my relationship with sensory soothing, all these different pieces that eventually I developed so much shame around, if I had been educated about it and educated about it in a way that was non-judgmental and supportive of what I needed, I probably wouldn't have developed an extreme eating disorder, certainly not one rooted in wanting to change my body in the first place. I may have struggled with what I still struggle with to this day, which is hyperfixating on something and not eating my food because until too late, or, you know, deciding that something I used to love now grosses me out entirely. Like, I still struggle with that, but that's what I would have struggled with instead of everything else.
Yeah. And I find it really interesting because, so, okay, like my whole mental health journey, and I've talked about this before, has been what came first, the chicken or the egg? It's been trying to like pinpoint what came first. And me and my therapist have gone back and forth about, do I have ADHD? Do I have autism? Do I have ADHD? Do I have autism? Back and forth. Yeah. Or even just like if they're kind of on the same thing. So you know, you might have both, or you might have just like the umbrella. And so we've talked a lot about like that. I've always had sensory issues. I was an incredibly picky eater as a kiddo. I would fixate on foods. Like, those were all things that I related to as a kid. And then I grew up in a diet culture household. And so then that played into it.
It colludes so heavily.
Yeah. And then, of course, just like, to be honest, growing up in the 90s to the 2000s compared to growing up in the 2010s are very different because the anorexia was a fashion trend from like, you know, the 90s to like 2011, 2012. And then it shifted to curvy being in. And I have heard rumblings.
Oh, yes. The heroin chic is back.
Anorexia is coming back as a fashion trend.
Yeah.
And let me just tell you, if we go back to low rise jeans, I'm not doing it. I'm not fucking doing it. And so, you know, it's a much different time to grow up now, and and you still have eating disorders being so prevalent, but like, it was so put, I mean, every fucking commercial was goddamn Nutrisystem or South Beach Diet or
South Beach
fucking Christy Alley up there telling us that everybody was
rest
fat.
In peace, and it Christy
was,
Alley
rest in peace Christy Alley.
And I was like, weight stigma killed her. That was the first thought that came to my head. I was like, this woman died in her 70s. She would not have died if she had been dieting her entire life.
She was also a raging Republican and kind of a bad person.
That too.
Maybe it's fine. Karma.
Maybe it's fine.
But it was just one of those things where everything lined up perfectly for most kids my age to have some sort of body dysmorphia, eating disorder, body hatred, something.
It's so true.
And the household obviously, like, really, I think, was a catalyst. Yeah. And then I hit like 15 and I start having trauma. And so then there's trauma, like, and I had trauma before then, but I had two really massive traumatic events. I was sexually assaulted at 15, sexually assaulted at 18. Mm. And of course, those things, when there's trauma that's inflicted against your body, I think it's really common to then go inward and think, okay, well, is there something wrong with my body? Is that why these things are happening to my body? Was I not good enough? Was I not pretty enough? Was I not skinny enough? And then that, you start down that rabbit hole. And then in college, I had thought that I had like kind of beat the whole diet thing because I never made the connection as a kid. Once again, the way that you're living it is not the way that you see it, you know, in hindsight. And it never hit me as a kid until I started actually doing therapy on the way that I viewed my body. But I got assaulted at 15 and then I had this massive, like, I don't know, like eating disorder peak.
Spike. Absolutely.
Where it was like the worst my eating disorder has ever been in my entire life. And I went from like a certain weight. I lost 70 pounds in the span of like 4 months. It was like horrifically, you know, condensed. And I was doing the whole, let's work out 4 times a day. How many cucumbers can we eat before we pass out? Like, it was just like the height of it. And it never clicked in my mind as a kid because I didn't know I was assaulted. And so once I hit, you know, the age of unpacking that trauma, it was like, oh, shit, these things are like very intertwined. And then I hit my 20s and I've started to unpack the body shame. I've started to unpack the body dysmorphia. And then you have the autism, ADHD, whatever was there that still is there that starts impacting the food habits. All right, for those of you who have been here for a bit, you've heard me talk about my pup, Stevie Ray. When Stevie was a puppy, she had some undiagnosed food allergies that resulted in her being super itchy. Luckily, we found Scouts Honor. Scouts Honor's products are probiotic and are lifesavers for pups with sensitive skin, who are prone to itchiness, or if you just want your pup to have the softest fur ever. We exclusively use Scouts Honor and have for the past 2.5 years. We love their unscented shampoo and conditioner and their probiotic paw spray, which is amazing for Frito-Toe pups. On top of their amazing products, with every bottle bought, they provide a meal for an animal in need. If you have a pet, I would highly encourage looking into Scouts Honor. And listeners of the podcast can use the code MINDFULMINDS for 20% off of a purchase of $50 or more. Again, that's code MINDFULMINDS for top-notch doggy grooming. I have been asked from so many people, how did you start your podcast? The answer is simple, Buzzsprout. I had no production experience when I started the show, and I used Buzzsprout's blog and website to teach myself how to get started. Buzzsprout not only lists your show on all major streaming platforms, but you also get access to a website, audio players, and custom sound bites. If you are looking to launch your dream podcast or you're looking for a new platform, Buzzsprout is the way to go. You can follow the link in our show notes to receive a $20 credit towards your membership, and you will be supporting our show. Happy podcasting.
And this is what I want to go into next is the prioritization of food. Because for me, for the last, let's say, five-ish years, the primary thing for my eating disorder has been I got so used to not prioritizing food, and food was at the very bottom of my priority list. And then I have this like time blindness, and I have this, I'll get fixated on a task and then it's 3 p.m. and I've eaten nothing. And so you have these things where it never became a habit or a priority for food to be at the top of my list because of the body issues. But then I've started to like, now if I skip a meal, I would say maybe 0.5 out of 10 times it's because of a body thing. And the rest of the time, the other 95% of the time, it's because I was distracted, or I wasn't, there wasn't a schedule, or I got too focused. Or like you mentioned, I only had food in my house that sounded kind of gross and made me feel really icky. And like, I was like, oh gosh, I don't want to eat that. And so then I don't eat anything. And it was also one of the reasons why my Uber Eats bill in college was astronomical because it was the only time that I ate was if I could like order something that in that moment didn't make me feel sensory icky and gross. So with all that being said, the prior, I've heard this from so many people, so many like specifically women in their 20s who grew up in the diet culture household, are now unpacking the body dysmorphia, and they still have that lingering, oh shit, I don't know how to prioritize food and actually eat because I get lost in this time blindness, or I get lost in the forgetfulness or the brain fog or whatever. So how can things like that impact? And also, how do you, what are there, is there a remedy to that? Are there tools? Like what are the ways to kind of reorient that scheduling, or even, you know, little tips and tricks to remind or, you know, whatever. Well, before we dive into that, I did just want to, reemphasize what you said about trauma, flaring up these conditions. I actually, it's interesting that you shared that that happened to you at 15, because the exact same thing happened to me at about 14, 15. It was a long stretch of inappropriate sexual behavior, we'll say. And, my eating disorder, what was disordered eating, became a full blown eating disorder. From that, it really pushed me over the edge for sure. So, definitely, co-sign that just in terms of a lived experience. In terms of what you're talking about, with the ADHD and food, I think there are so many different ways that this can go, right? So again, I can speak from personal experience. What you described, you know, getting so hyperfixated that you wait till the end of the day, or it's 3 o'clock. Oh shit, I haven't eaten. Like I that happens to me so much. And what you were saying too, in terms of like right now, it's like 0.5%. It's a body image thing. Most of the time, it's all this other bullshit. 100%. And that is something that I work on with my clients and with myself. There's one piece that I wanted to make sure I said. What was it? Time blindness, forgetfulness. So when we have an eating disorder, generally speaking, one of the things that you were describing in your experience was that food was so not a priority. And that certainly does happen. For other people, food becomes the hyperfixation in and of itself. And so it's always the priority. And there's such a scarcity around food that it is always enticing. There is always something novel about it, something that tickles that dopamine part of our brain when we engage with it. Right. And so when we heal from our eating disorder, for some of us, what ends up happening is food just isn't that fucking interesting anymore. It is really goddamn boring. And so the idea that you want to, that you need to break your hyperfocus, which is like feeding you all this good dopamine feeling, to go eat something that is not going to do that at all. Who wants to do that?
Right.
So it leads into this food avoidance, which is why I was mentioning ARFID when I was talking about that, because that's really what it is. It's an avoidant response to food that has nothing to do with your body size, but is, you just don't want it.
Do you mind giving a quick definition of ARFID?
Yeah.
We've never talked about that on the podcast.
Yeah. It's avoidant, A-R, avoidant, restrictive, feeding, an intake disorder.
Okay.
Avoidant restrictive feeding and intake disorder. And basically, ARFID is picky eating, quote unquote, mm-hmm. without the presence of body image distress. So it's being avoidant gotcha. Around food, not because you're trying to control your body size. It's what okay. many children who are on the ASD spectrum will be diagnosed with when they have their experience of quote unquote picky eating.
Okay. Yeah. I know it like colloquially, but yeah. like, I don't think I'd ever actually looked at the definition. Yes. Okay. So now that we have that, were you in the middle of a thought? I feel like
was I? I don't know. Who knows? but ARFID, yes. So, oh, right. So basically, a lot of times, you know, we may have the experience that you describe, but we can also have the experience wherein when we're in our eating disorder, we are always thinking about food. You know, whether right. we're eating it or not, we're always thinking about it. And so the opportunity to eat is a really exciting opportunity, or it's really dreadful. But even if it's dreadful, it's still exciting. It's still like titillating. It's mm-hmm. that chemical shit in your brain, you know? And so like even things that are distressing can feel good. Not good yeah. in like the warm, fuzzy good, but like good in like the familiar good.
Yeah.
So for some of us, what ends up happening is food just isn't a priority anymore. And it doesn't feel like this thing that we're never going to get again because we know we're going to feed ourselves. So the push to feed ourselves then dissipates. And so we do have to figure out how we get ourselves to eat. And that can be various things. One of those things is takeout. Uber Eats yeah. is like my fucking godsend. And thank God I'm in a financial position that I can do that. But, you know, there's nothing wrong with takeout. Anything that's low spoons is going to be much easier to convince yourself to eat. You know, something that you need to
do you want to explain low spoons?
Oh, low spoons. I'm sorry.
We've also never talked about spoons.
But spoon theory. Okay. Yep. So, oh gosh, can I give a definition of this? So,
I can give kind of a brief one if you
okay,
want.
Okay, go for it.
I think I understand the gist of it. It's essentially yeah. like something for neurodivergent people to almost express, like, you know, I only have this many spoons. In my, you know, in my whatever, like I only have yep. this much energy right now. And so I can only do a low spoon activity or a high spoon activity, whatever. Low spoon insinuates that you don't have enough energy to do something higher, or enough mental stamina or space or whatever, yeah. whatever is.
It's like an energy exchange theory.
Right. Right. Yeah. So a lot of you'll hear, especially a lot on social media, a lot of neurodivergent creators, like saying things about, oh yeah, sorry, I've received so many DMs when I reach out to people for podcasts and they're like, oh, I don't have the spoons for that right yeah. now. And I'm like, yeah. I had to look it up because I was like, yeah. what the fuck does that mean? I was like, I don't know what that means.
It's a little,
means. Yeah. But yeah, strange, okay. But. So if you don't have, you know, low spoon, you said low spoon.
Yeah. Food. So low spoon meals. And I do think that the spoon theory was born out of the disability movement, just as an FYI.
Okay. Good to know.
But yeah, so basically it's another way to say like a low effort thing. Right. So frozen food, microwave food, you know, things that are fast, eggs are so fast. Sorry for the vegans out there. But you know, like stuff like that can be really helpful. Also, if you've got a hyperfixation food, fucking eat it. Eat it for three yeah. meals in the day. It doesn't matter. Just eat it.
I ate a Whole Foods frozen thing of broccoli for like 2 weeks. That was like all I ate because it was this one broccoli that I put this one like jalapeno, the crunchy onion jalapeno stuff from Trader Joe's. Mm-hmm. I lived on that shit for like 2 weeks straight.
Yeah. If it works, it works, you know? And that's also where the eating disorder stuff comes in too, sort of like in an orthorexic style, we may have this belief that we can't eat the same thing, mm-hmm. you know, many days in a row, many meals in
or
a row
because food.
Or frozen foods or convenience foods because they're quote unquote unhealthy. And so many of the things that help ADHDers feed ourselves are also things that are considered by like the broader food culture as bad, junk food, unhealthy, that kind of stuff. Right. So that can also create a whole other, you know, aspect of struggle around preparing food for yourself. And in terms of like the forgetfulness and prioritization, part of this is just understanding that this is how your brain works and giving yourself a little bit of goddamn grace for it because you're not going to be perfect at it and that's okay. Right. So that is like baseline. And then of course we want to do what we can to help. ourselves, right? Something that I find to be a helpful reminder, especially for those of us who kind of live at this intersection, is that your ADHD symptoms are going to become more unruly the less well-nourished you are.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, if you do not attend to your nourishment needs and your sleep needs and your hydration needs, and some movement needs as well, that mm-hmm. includes like stretching and just, you know, simple, gentle movement, you are going to have more difficulty with your executive dysfunction. You are going to have more difficulty with your emotional regulation. You are overall going to be struggling more. And it becomes a vicious cycle because then it's harder to make your next meal. So, it's, you know, I say all of this, and I think a lot of us know this. It's the implementation of it that's the problem and the struggle. And that is something that I really, really recommend people work with their therapist on, or someone who's very familiar with ADHD, because the solutions are so individualized to what you need, to what your context is, to what you're capable of. You know, what works for me is not going to work for you. What worked for me today may not work for me tomorrow. What worked for me yesterday that didn't work for me today may actually work a month from now. Like, it's all so variable. And that's the nature of an ADHD brain. And it's one of the reasons why it's so hard to navigate. But it's why I think individualized approaches are so important, and learning how to do that, problem solving while also being compassionate, gentle, and curious. Like, that's the main kind of path.
Yeah. And okay, I want to say, first of all, I love movement needs instead of exercise, because when you're coming from an eating disorder mindset, I went from hyper exercising to lose weight to not moving my body at all for almost 3 years.
Just common.
Yeah, because it was just like I was trying to be so conscious of not triggering
myself. Doing it in a disordered way. Yeah.
Right. And so I just recently started engaging in yoga, because to me that didn't feel like I'm going to lose weight. And then I've talked about this on the podcast quite a bit, but I transitioned into rock climbing. And for some reason that felt like more of a hobby than exercise. And so I was able to like actually go out and like feel strong and feel empowered. And I always kind of, for, you know, the past like 4 years or so during the recovery process, whenever I felt strong, I almost felt like, oh no, I'm going to trigger my eating disorder again, because like I would feel, you know, I would feel strong when I would work out, and then I'd feel incredibly weak when I would deprive myself of food.
Right.
And so it was this weird balance. And so I remember like the first time I felt really strong while rock climbing, I was like, oh fuck, oh fuck. And me and my therapist even like put limitations. Like it was like, I was not allowed to rock climb more than twice a week. Like I wasn't allowed to do it more than twice a week, and I wasn't allowed to do it for more than like, I think it, cause like rock climbing, it's pretty common to rock climb for like 2 hours or so. Like you're not rock climbing that entire time. You're chatting and you're belaying other people and stuff. So it's not 2 hours of constant movement. So we kind of put like a time limit on it. And I also put a limit on it that anytime I went to go rock climbing with my friends, I'd go get pizza after. And it was intentional of like, cause you know, in eating disorders, it's really common to deprive yourself of food after you work out.
Yeah.
And I purposely was like, okay, well, I'm going to get tacos on Tuesday after I climb. And on Thursdays, I'm going to go to Mod and I'm going to get pizza. And so every single Thursday, I'd get a pizza. And I got so used to that and made such an intentional choice to do that, that it didn't feel like I was canceling anything out. Because it was just like a part of the process. Like I rock climb and I get pizza and there's nothing to think about. So I love movement needs. I love that word. And then on a follow-up on some of the tools, I thought I'd just share a few things that I found worked well for me. And once again, if this doesn't work for you, that's totally fine. For one, I found out that frozen foods nutritionally, like frozen vegetables and frozen fruit, literally are like so close to the same as fresh. It's not that big of a deal.
Actually, there are some of them that it is their peak freshness and then they're frozen. Yeah. So if if you go and pick a ripe fruit and then wait a few days to eat it, which like the amount of difference in,
who fucking cares?
It's like, come on, people. But the frozen food would actually be more nutrient dense. Yeah, nutrient dense.
Yeah, because that has been such a thing with, I mean, two things. It's been such a thing with the eating disorder culture that frozen foods are not fresh enough, not healthy enough, whatever.
It's bullshit.
And then it's also such a like horrible thing that has become colloquially agreed upon because of accessibility and like income, where it's literally just shitting on people who don't have income for fresh food and fresh vegetables. It's just like, okay, well, you know, so just as a heads up, like that's a myth. Frozen foods are still great. For me, I dedicate an entire shelf of my freezer to really like fast frozen foods, even if that was something that was like, in my head, maybe not the most like well-rounded meal. It was like, whatever, I'm, it's better for me. And someone, I think it was actually, it might've been my current partner. I think it was him that we were talking about, how do I feed myself? Mm-hmm. And he was like, well, it's better for you to eat 10 pot stickers than not eat anything. Like that.
Correct.
It's better. It's better for you to eat. It's just better for you to eat. It doesn't really matter what that is. If you eat a cookie and that's what you're able to eat, it's better for you to eat. And so I just kind of was like, I started adopting that mindset. Yeah. The other thing that's been really helpful for me with the time blindness and the forgetfulness and the brain fog, a food list has been really helpful. So having some sort of meal plan list, and not a meal plan, because I don't really do very well with actual meal plan scheduling, like where it's like Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, because then I get to Tuesday and I'm like, tacos sound disgusting.
Yeah, I don't want the thing I planned on.
I don't want that. But I have a list of potential meals that's like 40 meals long of meals that I knew that I liked. Because, and the other thing, people who follow me on Instagram, on my personal Instagram, probably just think I'm annoying, but I have a highlight on my Instagram reel called Happy Meals.
Oh no, I love, I used to do the same thing in my camera roll. And meals I know pictures. I like.
And I post them on a highlight because it's the easiest way to just like go and retrieve them. And the visual aspect really helps because it'll show me, that looks really good. Like, oh, maybe I'll make that. And so having something to like give your brain, because I think like with ADHD and also trauma, object permanence can kind of not be great. Yep. And so unless you're seeing it in front of your face and like your memory might not pick it up on
it. It does not exist.
And so, so that was successful for me. Also like doing a Pinterest board of meals that I know I've already tried and been successful at. That's been helpful. Having a rotating like grocery list of groceries that like kind of are always like my base level where I can maybe build something out of it, and always including frozen food, always including snacks. And then
I even like to post that list on my fridge, because with the object permanence thing, being able to see it and not have to like do the whole thing where you open the fridge and just stare at the fridge sadly, because that's very discouraging.
I've also, I don't know where it was, and maybe if I find it, I can post in the episode notes, but I've heard of like, if you have a magnetic fridge, there are ADHD like grocery magnets that some people will make. I think they're on Etsy or something.
Probably.
And they're these really cute, aesthetically pleasing little magnets, and it makes it kind of fun and like a little game. And you have like one side of things that are in your fridge, and you have it on the outside of your fridge. So you could just see it. And then when you run out of something, you move it over to the other side. And it's these magnets that actually look like the things that you're eating. Cause even I found that like, if I just put like a list with like words, my eyes just kind of zoop,
glaze over it.
I just go right over it. But if it's something pretty and visual and like, like that's a carrot, I'm out of carrots. Then it's like, it'll click. So those are all things that I found helpful. And then I have friends who have ADHD that have tried out some of these things. And then
are all the ones that I recommend to patients as well.
Yeah. And then I will say too, the other one that I found helpful, which I can link this because I know for a fact I got this on Etsy. There's a little magnet that I found. This guy on TikTok was selling them, and he was making them, and he makes them for a whole bunch of different things, but they have one for food, and it's a little magnet, and it says like, I think it's like meals or something. And it says breakfast, lunch, dinner. And there's a little doop, doop, doop.
Oh, like a slide. Like I did
a little slider. Yeah. And so after you eat, you slide it. And let me tell you, I fucking suck at ever doing it. It's been on my fridge for like 2 years, and I maybe do it like once every 5 minutes, but, five months. but if that's something that, you know, you like the tactileness of it, that might be helpful. It would be so helpful for me if I ever actually did it, but since I don't, it doesn't do too much.
Right. I think one thing that can be
hiccup.
Exactly. And one thing that can be helpful in that realm, and this works for various things. Like for example, I know every ADHDer under the sun has been recommended to use a planner. Planners do not work unless you have a planning day that is baked into your week. So like when I was in college, Sunday was my planning day. And so I'd sit down with my planner and I'd go through my whole week and I'd do it every Sunday. Because if I didn't do it every Sunday, I had no fucking idea what was going on and my planner never got used. So having like a habitual check-in for yourself. Like sometimes we do that with grocery shopping too, like with the eating disorder intersection, because grocery shopping can be so daunting, and not having groceries in the house, having too many, like having them go to waste, all this stuff. So prioritizing a grocery day, having a grocery shopping day so that when Sunday rolls around, it's like, okay, it's time to go get groceries so that it's not Wednesday and you've got nothing.
Yep.
So having those touch points is helpful.
I've got like I clean every Thursday.
Exactly.
And I know from the grocery perspective too, because the having things go bad is so disappointing.
Yeah.
You spend money and things go bad and you just forget they're there. I know for me, I tried just managing that for a year, like when I first lived on my own and was in an apartment by myself and I was the only one eating food. I gave up on it. I was like, you know what?
Food's gonna go bad.
Well, I also was like, I'm just going to do fucking frozen vegetables. Like, why am I doing this?
With the produce, right? In terms of looking at what goes bad. Why the fuck am
I doing this? Like, I was like, I was buying bags of spinach and I would buy a new bag of spinach.
No, that's always
going to
go bad.
Every fucking
week,
and it would go bad. And so now the only things that I will buy fresh is that are the, you know, produce. I'll buy cilantro because I figured out that I like putting it in a little mason jar. And for me, it looks pretty and then it stays fresh longer.
Mason jars are a big hack for fresh vegetables and fruits.
Yeah, mason jars are fantastic. And then I'll buy citrus. I'll buy oranges and limes and lemons because they don't go bad as often.
Yep,
and
citrus are great.
And then I'll buy apples. And then if I buy any specific thing that I need for a meal, that's different. Like if I'm planning on making like something with jalapenos, then I'll buy jalapenos. But if it's something that's just like a habitual, I'm just going to go to the grocery store and get what I need. I buy frozen broccoli. I buy frozen potatoes, frozen green beans, frozen strawberries, frozen mango, frozen, like everything. You will never see me with a fucking banana. Because they go bad so fast.
They go bad so fast.
I just moved in with my partner and he was like, I love bananas. And I was like, well, you better eat all of them because I will never touch them. And I, every once in a while I can eat one.
Yeah.
90% of the time the texture makes me want to die.
It's a textural nightmare. I really can't do it.
So things like that. I know some people are like really big overnight oats people because that can last for a little while. For me, the texture icks me out. So I tried it and I can't really do it. But even like, I hate having to cook. And so I get frozen rice now. I get frozen quinoa. I don't do the whole let's try to make it because it'll sit in my closet or in my cabinet or my pantry for 6 months and then it goes bad. And so just there's so much societal, like this is good, this is bad when it comes to food. And I think the biggest hurdle I had to get over with the mindset of the ADHD or autism and the eating disorder was – it doesn't fucking matter. I'm going to figure out how to rewrite my game plan to fit my life, fit my routine. Because if I don't, I'm not going to eat.
Exactly.
And at the end of the day, like me eating needs to be the number one priority.
The priority.
If that means that I'm eating pizza every day, I'm fucking eating pizza every day.
Listen,
at least I'm eating.
There's a fruit in that. There's a grain in that.
You got some veggies. You got some cheese. You can put some pepperoni on it. You're hitting some boxes.
Yeah. Like you got all your macros.
But yeah. So I think there's, I mean, if I find any other tools, I'll let you guys know. But I want to end.
Oh, I just wanted to, because you were talking about like setting limits for yourself and rules and stuff. And one thing that I think is really important is as people who have experienced trauma and as people who have ADHD, we do not like being told what to do. And so one of my things that I talk to my clients a lot about is flexible boundaries. Is you can do whatever you want to do, but what's actually going to be helpful? Right. Mm-hmm. So, for example, with your rock climbing thing, you could become disordered with it. You are allowed. You're a grown ass adult. You can do whatever you want. But is that what you want?
Right.
And I think that permissiveness across the board can help us help ourselves because a lot of us at least have internalized this like self-shaming voice that's like, you need to do this and you need to do that. And none of us like that voice. All of us want to shoot that voice in the head. So like, we're not going to listen to it. And we may actively rebel against it, actually, even if it's the thing that we genuinely want. So right. I try to look at it in a slightly different way of like, I can do whatever I want. And what is going to be the most supportive for me in the long run? What is tomorrow Asher going to be happy about?
Yeah. And I think, I mean, even with the boundaries with the rock climbing, I think if my therapist had been the one to suggest that, I would have felt attacked.
Yeah.
And she wasn't the one to suggest. Mm-hmm. I walked in and was like, I want to rock climb. We need to put some fucking boundaries on this, because if this reignites my disordered exercising, I'm going to be pissed.
Right. And those boundaries are so important, right? I just think it's important that they're also flexible and responsive, right?
Because yeah. Well, and that was the thing. They initially started off as, you know, I can only go twice a week. And then after the first month or two of me doing it and me realizing, okay, hang on, I'm not falling back into this. My mind is viewing this for some, whatever reason, thank God it is in some other box in my brain where it's just, I'm not viewing it as how can I, you know, make whatever, how can this. I lose weight? Yeah. And so then the boundaries did change. It was like, okay, well maybe I need to, I started going 3 to 4 times a week. And then I realized my body told me absolutely
that was too much.
You cannot go 4 times a week.
Yeah.
And I immediately developed an elbow injury, like immediately, because my body was like, no. Mm-hmm. And even to the point where I set boundaries with the people that I went rock climbing with.
Yeah.
I stopped going rock climbing with someone who was making it competitive.
Yep.
Because I was like, dude, I used to like exercise like 3 to 4 times a day because I was so obsessed with losing weight. This cannot get competitive for me. It has to be fun. It has to be like just carefree and a hobby.
Because then the OCD of it all just becomes so ignited.
Exactly. It was just like, I knew myself well enough. And honestly, I used to really shame myself for the fact that I didn't start moving my body sooner.
Mm.
And looking back on it, I think if I had tried to rock climb 3 years ago, I would have fallen back into disordered exercise so fast.
Yeah.
And I waited until I knew that I was like firm enough in my boundaries, firm enough in knowing how my body worked, how my brain worked, how my disordered thoughts worked, and where to know the red flags to cut things off immediately if I needed to.
Yep.
Because it was like, nothing is worth this disorder coming back for me.
Yep.
I will find a different fucking hobby. It's not worth it. And even to the point where I found some different friends. I cut off some friends because it was like, this is not healthy for me. Mm-hmm. And so I knew all of that going in. And so if you are having to take breaks or having to, even if like, you know, you can't handle cooking right now because it's too whatever – they're like, it's hard to say, like, be as shame-free as you can, because the world is shaming and your mind can be shaming and your family can be shaming.
Be as permissive and compassionate and gentle with yourself as you can. Yes, the world is a harsh fucking place, and a lot of people around us do not look kindly on the ways that we take care of ourselves. But the fact of the matter is, you are doing your best to take care of yourself with the tools that you have and the resources that you have, and that is enough, and that matters.
Right. And I want to just end on, if you were to have one first step or helpful tool that you can give someone who maybe has just entered into an ADHD diagnosis, maybe they just realized that they have ADHD and there's an eating disorder or whatever, what would you say? What would one first step be for someone?
Oh my God, that's such a big question. First step. Well, this is a I know what I want to say, but I think I need to caveat it. I think that the most important thing is connecting back to your intuition. And that is really difficult when we live in an ableist world, when we live in a very traumatizing world, because our intuition doesn't develop in a vacuum. And so we may become fearful of things that we don't actually need to be fearful of, and vice versa. And so our intuition can lead us astray, especially in the beginning of things when we don't really know the lay of the land. That being said, the only way to figure out how to help yourself is to be in communication with yourself. And so connecting with that intuition is so, so important. And it has to be done really gently, especially if you have a trauma history, because being connected to yourself could feel really unsafe. So, you know, all those caveats included, I would say that the most helpful first step is trying to be in communication with yourself and your own intuition.
That's a great answer. That's one. I was just talking about this on a trauma episode. Mm. That is one thing that I was not expecting with trauma healing was how much I had completely become disconnected with my intuition.
Oh yeah. It's essential. It's the only way to do it. It's the only way to survive in such traumatizing situations. Yeah.
Yeah. And I will say, and, I believe it was episode 55. We were just talking about intuition and practices for intuition. And so if you are coming out of trauma, if you're coming out of an environment where it's not safe to trust your mind and trust yourself, something that has been helpful for me is finding really low risk environments to practice my intuition.
Yeah.
So whether that's like a really fun app where you have to just like green or blue, literally just like random things that are so incredibly low risk. I talked about this in episode 55, but for me, my boyfriend loves football and loves football picks. And so he has started letting me do his football picks because he doesn't bet anything. It's just for fun. And so he will rattle off all the teams to me and I'll go Eagles, Jets, Seahawks, and just like whatever feels right. I don't think about who plays for the team. I don't think about, and it's just a fun exercise of just practicing like gut reaction to things. And obviously that's not quite a mirror of your actual intuition, but it just kind of helps you practice like the decision making and the, I'm just going to trust my gut. And it's really low risk. Like it's helpful to practice that before you get into environments where maybe it is a little bit, there's more on the table. And then, like you said, like if you do get an environment where there's more on the table and your intuition isn't, you know, what you thought it was, then, you know, pick yourself up and try to start over again.
And you learn. You just learn. Yeah. It's all a learning experience. Looking at everything like a learning experience whenever we can.
Isn't it all?
Yeah. I mean, that's in my humble opinion, you have to look at it that way because otherwise we put too much stock into so many little choices. And at the end of the day, it's just, you can't, you drive yourself batty.
Yeah, for sure. Well, thank you so much for coming on.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Oh my God, we've been scheduling for like a year, 2 years.
It's been a long time.
It's been a while.
But I'm so glad we finally got to have it because I think it's so relevant. I think it's something that so many of my listeners have expressed interest in. So I'm so glad that we finally got to have it. And I want to make sure that people have a chance to find you and follow you and listen to more of your wonderful wisdom and knowledge. Do you want to share where people can find you online?
Yeah. So best place to find me is on Instagram at @badashtherapy. I am also on TikTok and Twitter. And maybe Pinterest under that username, I think. And then my website is ashermsaruya.com. I sell art of my art is recovery, mental health oriented. Some of it is.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah. Some of it is like infographics. Like I do a lot of educational content on health at every size and weight stigma. And then some of it's just more, you know, art, pretty stuff. But yeah, so it's a fun little website. You should check it out.
That's amazing. And it's ashermsaruya.com.
Mm-hmm.
Perfect. Okay. Well, thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate it. I'm so glad we finally got to talk.
Yeah. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, of course. That's all the time that we have for today. Thank you guys so much for listening. And if you enjoyed the podcast, please rate us 5 stars on iTunes and Spotify and leave us a review. You can also follow the podcast on Instagram at @mindfulmindspod and visit us online at mindfulmindspod.com. That website is now the host of everything for the podcast. And we also have press, our podcast services, frequently asked questions, and how to sponsor the podcast. We also changed our email. So if you're trying to get a hold of us, you can now email us at mindfulmindspod@gmail.com. And as always, to end our time, unclench your jaw, take a deep breath, and remember, you can always learn, you can always grow, and you can always choose to live your life in a more mindful way. I will chat with you guys in 2 weeks.